Human papillomaviruses, or HPVs, are small double-stranded DNA viruses that may infect human epithelium at different body sites. To date, there are over 170 different HPV types described, and many are linked to cancers. In this dialogue, Dr. Sarah Aaron and Dr. Christine J. Coe are going to take us on an overview of HPV and squamous cell carcinoma.
My name is Christine Coe, and today I'm interviewing Sarah Aaron, who's an assistant professor and director of the University of California at San Francisco High-Risk Skin Cancer Program. So welcome to Dr. Aaron.
Thank you.
Today, Dr. Aaron is going to talk about human papillomavirus, we'll probably abbreviate most times as HPV, and skin cancer. So the first thing I wanted to ask her was, what's known about HPV and squamous cell carcinoma?
What we know about HPV and squamous cell carcinoma is really different for the cervical and anogenital cancers as it is for skin cancer, particularly non-melanoma squamous cell carcinomas. In 1983, Harald Zurhausen was a virologist who effectively demonstrated that the vast majority of cervical cancers are caused by HPV, human papillomavirus, and particularly the high-risk types 16 and 18 that people have heard about. Ever since then, we've wanted to believe that cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma is also caused by the same virus, but the data there is a little bit more controversial, and it's been an active area of study over the past 20 years.
Okay. So I guess basically, in a way, we don't really know yet the role of HPV in cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma.
It's not clear yet. There have been many studies showing an association of HPV with squamous cell carcinoma. And what I mean by that is that if you take tumor tissue from a patient and look for the virus in the tumor tissue by a variety of methods, including PCR and in situ hybridization, you are more likely to find virus in that tissue than if you take normal skin, either from patients with squamous cell carcinoma or normal skin from normal healthy donors. There have been over 50 papers looking at this field, and in fact, a lot of the controversy has arisen from differences in results between these papers. And I think the differences really arise from different methods used for testing for HPV. But if you look at the papers in aggregate, there does appear to be some clear association between carriage of the virus on the skin and the occurrence of squamous cell carcinoma.
So you mentioned HPV subtype 16 and 18 with the cervical cancer, and then also how people keep kind of hoping that the same subtypes are involved in cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. So can you just tell a little bit about the HPV subtype, sort of the phylogeny of HPV?
Sure. So HPV refers to a large family of double-stranded DNA viruses. They're small circles, episomes, that live in your cell, only about 8 kilobases long. But it turns out that among the HPV family, there are over 100 and nearly 200 types of HPV. And these fall into 5 main genuses or genera: the alpha, beta, gamma, mu, and nu. Of these genuses, the alpha genus is primarily composed of the HPV types that infect anogenital or cervical mucosal epithelium. And that includes high-risk types 16 and 18 or 31 and 33. It does include a few types that infect cutaneous epithelium, like HPV 3 and 27. The beta genus is the types that are more commonly found on cutaneous epithelium. And this contains what we used to call the epidermodysplasia verusiformis, or EV type HPVs. And those include HPV 5 and 8, as well as others. Common warts can be caused by gamma, mu, or nu types. And so there's really a broad spectrum of HPV types, and one HPV is not necessarily like another. So what we know about HPV 16 and 18, the high-risk types that cause cervical cancer, is that they're able to transform keratinocytes into cancer in ways that other HPV types, such as HPV 5 and 8 on the skin, are not. So we can't assume that one HPV is the same as another in terms of the molecular mechanism by which they cause disease.
Sounds good. So since you mentioned the cutaneous warts versus anogenital and then the EV subtypes, what do you tell your patients with cutaneous warts in non-genital sites versus genital sites then, if they ask like, oh, you know, am I at risk for cancer or not?
I think that's an excellent question, and I'll break it down into patients with common warts or verruca and patients who have anogenital disease. Patients who develop common warts are usually very psychologically disturbed by the fact that they have them. They come in for frequent destructive treatments, and I always tell them, I'm going to do something to try and destroy the wart tissue that's here. I don't have anything that can cure or destroy the virus that causes the wart. So it is possible that they will get warts in other places. I remind them that even though common warts are caused by virus, they are technically contagious, but we don't consider them contagious because those wart viruses are ubiquitous. Nearly everybody carries HPV on the skin. And so I don't like to associate the stigma of contagion on patients with common warts. Patients who have genital warts or even genital high-risk squamous cell carcinoma or Bowen's disease, I think need a little bit of a different type of counseling because in those situations, the HPV truly is a sexually transmitted disease. When I diagnose a patient with genital warts, I typically talk to them about discussing it with their partner or if their partner's in the room. I'm happy to facilitate that discussion. I think female partners of patients with penile warts or perianal warts need to be screened by pap smear. Certainly routine screening for women is effective and one can add HPV typing to improve the diagnostic sensitivity of pap smear. I have male partners of patients with genital warts and there are anal paps available. At UCSF, we have an anal dysplasia clinic. At other hospitals, you might consider referring to colorectal surgery for an anal pap smear. And I think that kind of screening is very helpful. A person can be HPV typed. Carrying HPV doesn't guarantee that you'll get genital disease. So it's a very sensitive tool, but it's not necessarily specific. And I like to talk to patients about whether that's going to make them more worried or less worried about their own medical care. People who have truly invasive genital squamous cell carcinoma carry HPV types that are different from people with condyloma. Condyloma are typically low-risk HPV types 6 and 11, and condyloma do not turn into squamous cell carcinoma. Squamous cell carcinoma carrying a high-risk type such as 16 and 18, it is associated with having had condyloma because if you carry one HPV type through sexual transmission, you likely carry more. But I also tell patients, it doesn't mean that this wart that I'm freezing today is going to turn into a cancer, just that we have to watch you very closely.
Okay. So when you mentioned then that patients with condyloma are a little bit higher risk then for developing a cancer in the genital area because just by virtue of the fact they have HPV, but I guess that's not really true for a patient with a cutaneous wart. They're not necessarily at risk to develop, say, even Bowen's disease on the finger.
Correct. Having warts on the skin does not necessarily put a standard immunocompetent patient at risk for developing squamous cell carcinoma. And I want to reiterate again that although we have a clear association of carriage of this virus with cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, we don't have a molecular mechanism to really demonstrate that this virus causes cancer and how. The case is a little bit different for immunosuppressed organ transplant recipients. There's some very nice work out of European cohorts where having multiple keratotic lesions, flat warts or verrucous papillomas, is associated with a higher risk of squamous cell carcinoma in those patients. But in that case, I think it's more reflective of their overall level of immunosuppression, that you're more likely to get warts and more likely to get cancer, and not that your warts themselves will degenerate into carcinoma.
So you mentioned before also that when a patient has cutaneous warts, you tell them it is an infectious agent, but you don't really say that they can contaminate others since most people have been exposed, at least for sure, for HPV. So what is known about reservoirs of HPV? I mean, where are we getting this from when you get a cutaneous wart?
You know, it's difficult to know where HPV is coming from. I often counsel my patients, it's kind of like getting tinea pedis or athlete's foot at the gym. It is everywhere, and we probably acquire it during our childhoods. We don't fully know how HPV is transmitted. We believe that the virus infects basal epithelium through minor abrasions and then reproduces itself and creates more virions as the keratinocyte life cycle occurs with maturation. Where we do find HPV on the skin is truly everywhere. You can do skin swabs of normal skin. One very popular method for epidemiology studies is to do an eyebrow pluck because HPV has a reservoir in the hair follicle. Interestingly, genital HPVs can wax and wane, and there's some question about whether screening as a cross-sectional tool to identify women who carry HPV is as effective as doing longitudinal screening. So there may be instances where the body's immune system is able to clear it or detectable viral disease occurs. We haven't done anything like that on the skin, so I can't really draw those parallels.
Is that also related to what you were referring to before when you mentioned briefly that, say, a partner of someone with condyloma could be subtyped for HPV? Is that what you're referring to, sort of a genital swab or?
So a female partner would go to her gynecologist and have HPV testing. It can be done by genital swab. It can also be done, the more common method is antibody testing to see if you carry HPV antibodies, and that's a blood test.
It reflects more on cervical squamous cell cancer, but on the molecular level, what are some of the potential mechanisms by which these high-risk genital subtypes cause cancer?
It's actually an area that's of interest to me. When we think about HPV causing squamous cell carcinoma, as dermatologists, we like to ask the question of whether HPV causes skin cancer, and we revert to the analogy of cervical cancer. And so I think understanding how HPV causes cervical cancer will help us to understand how it may cause cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. High-risk HPV, such as 16 and 18, typically infect cervical epithelium and reproduce as the epithelium matures and sheds. And typically what happens in a cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, which is analogous to our actinic keratoses, is that the virus will be making many copies of itself, packaging and releasing. And then as the keratinocyte sheds, the virus is released and is available to reinfect at the basal level. But there is an aberrant event that occurs, and nobody's quite sure why it occurs, in which the HPV accidentally integrates into the genome of the cell. And virologists in the audience will know that this is a double-stranded DNA virus. It's not a retrovirus, so it's not supposed to integrate. But this event occurs where it integrates, it loses part of its genome and keeps other genes. And then as those cells divide, the HPV is present in every cell. Two of the genes that the HPV retains are called E6 and E7. And what we understand about E6 and E7 is that they interact with proteins of the cell cycle. E6 interacts with E6-associated protein, and it interferes with P53 function. And E7 interacts with hypophosphorylated retinoblastoma protein, which prevents progression through the cell cycle. So what we have is a situation where the HPV blocks the cell's normal machinery for preventing an abnormal or cancerous cell from dividing. And therefore, the cell begins to divide and divide and divide, and it turns into a frank invasive squamous cell carcinoma. One of the things that my laboratory is very interested in doing is seeing whether this mechanism is recapitulated in cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. And the first thing that we did was to look at how much HPV is present there. And if we quantify the amount of HPV DNA in cervical cancer, it ranges from about 2 to 6 copies per cell. And that HPV is present in every cell. But when we look at cutaneous squamous cell cancer, most commonly the HPV is present at fewer than 1 copy per cell. And in the vast majority of tumors, it's more like 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 cells. So it doesn't explain how these cancerous cells are progressing through the cell cycle unchecked because there's no virus in them to stop the normal regulatory mechanisms. So we went on to ask whether it's possible that the HPV integration event does something to interfere with cell cycle regulation. And we used a combination of deep sequencing methods to look for this. And in fact, we don't find any evidence of integration, and we don't find any molecular changes in the genome of the squamous cell cancer, depending on whether it has HPV in or not. So far, we're really unclear on how HPV works if it is, in fact, causing this cancer. My instinct, and I think many of my colleagues agree, is that HPV may be functioning with what we call a hit-and-run mechanism, that it's interacting with the cell in an early actinic keratosis and somehow destabilizing that cell so that when UV-induced mutations occur, the cell is then predisposed to cancer. But once it becomes cancerous, the HPV is no longer required to maintain that cancer state. And so we're working actively to try and solve these questions, and hopefully we'll have those answers. I think understanding how HPV causes squamous cell carcinoma is going to give us the opportunity to improve our diagnostic mechanisms. We'll be able to have more accurate screening tests for our patients. We could imagine therapeutic interventions where we're targeting the virus viral proteins, or we're targeting the cell cycle proteins that the virus is manipulating. There's certainly the potential for prognostic information to be gained by HPV typing. In fact, squamous cell carcinoma of the head and neck, so the internal cancers that our head and neck colleagues treat, are actually commonly caused by high-risk HPV types, just like cervical cancer. And in fact, tumors that are HPV positive are significantly more sensitive to chemotherapy and radiation than tumors that are HPV negative. So in that setting, it's a good sign, and it would be very interesting to know if HPV presence in skin cancers makes them more sensitive to different kinds of treatment or more likely to recur after surgery. And then finally, if we were able to develop a vaccine for non-melanoma skin cancer that's analogous to the cervical cancer vaccine we have now, then we could dramatically reduce one of the most common types of human cancers.
Sure, absolutely. That was a great explanation of some of the molecular mechanisms. Just to clarify, when you said the only one thing that I wanted to ask about was that for cervical cancer, HPV is, say, 2 to 6 copies per cell, but cutaneous skin cancer, at most, it's 1 copy per cell or 1 copy per 100 or 1,000 keratinocytes. Are those HPV subtypes the high-risk ones, or is it variable? Or?
That's an excellent question. No, in fact, the most common types that are seen in skin cancers are the epidermodysplasia verusiformis types, the EV types, otherwise known as the beta genus. These are most common, and HPV 5 and 8 are frequently seen, 19, 20, and 21, and it becomes a sort of alphabet soup of HPV types. Primarily, we don't see the high-risk type 16 and 18 in skin cancer, with one notable exception, which is periungual squamous cell carcinoma. I don't know if that represents a special site, but we typically see high-risk HPV, particularly 16, in those tumors. This may be why they're more aggressive than squamous cell carcinoma on the back of the hand or at non-nail bed sites on the digit. We don't truly know how it gets there, although there's some consideration that it's probably genital to digital transmission.
You had mentioned before that the beta genus, the EV, epidermodysplasia verusiformis subtypes, they are different than the high-risk genital. So does that mean that they don't normally integrate in the way that the high-risk ones do for cervical?
So we don't have any evidence of beta genus HPV types integrating. There hasn't been a lot of research in the area. I think new technologies in genomics and high-throughput sequencing are going to make it much easier for us to detect integration events. But for the most part, I think the common thinking is that they don't integrate. And really, that integration event, when we do see it in cervical cancer, is an accident, and it's not part of the HPV life cycle.
Epidermodysplasia verusiformis patients with the genodermatosis, say, are at increased risk for skin cancer, but it sounds like then maybe partially because they have EV subtypes, but also the UV-induced damage.
There is much stronger epidemiologic evidence for HPV, and particularly HPV 5 and 8, and squamous cell carcinoma in EV patients. In fact, the IARC, which is the organization that grades all potential carcinogens, recognizes HPV 5 and 8 as carcinogens, but only in patients with EV, not in the general population. And I think you're right that there is some interaction with UV radiation, because even in patients with EV and widespread EV type lesions, they tend to get their squamous cell cancers on sun exposed sites.
All right. Well, you know, it's been a great pleasure to interview you. Do you have any last thoughts on this subject?
I think it's a fascinating field. I think the more I read about it, the more I become confused. We've tried to make some headway in terms of simplifying the detailed virology for the general dermatology audience. And hopefully, as we understand the molecular mechanisms a little better, they'll become a little easier to explain. I think certainly things that are complex are the things that deserve more research.
Well, thank you very much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you.
The role of HPV infection in cutaneous warts was first described in the 1960s, and then in 1977, Harold Zurhausen reported on the role of HPV in the development of cervical cancer, for which he was awarded a Nobel Prize. In fact, numerous studies have shown a critical role for HPV in the development of different types of cancer, specifically in cancers derived from the cervix, vagina, vulva, anus, penis, and oropharynx. It is estimated that approximately 4.8% of the new cancers occurring in 2008 worldwide were due to high-risk HPV types from the alpha genus infections. Keratinocyte carcinomas, or basal cells and squamous cell carcinomas, are by far the most common cancers in Caucasian populations. Solar UVB radiation, chemicals, Rntgen radiation, smoking, and immunosuppressive medication all contribute to the development of keratinocyte carcinomas. Furthermore, recent evidence suggests that HPVs belonging to the beta genus can act as cofactors in the development of UV-induced carcinomas, especially in immunocompromised patients. While studies performed in patients with primary and acquired immunodeficiencies showed associations between markers of beta PV infections and keratinocyte carcinomas, the role of beta PV in skin cancers has not been fully established. In this dialogue, Dr. Aaron clarifies the existing data on the role of HPV in the development of squamous cell carcinoma. While cervical cancer is caused by HPV type 16 and 18, the role of HPV in squamous cell carcinoma is more controversial. Using PCR and in situ hybridization, HPV is more commonly found in tumor tissue than in normal skin, and there is likely an association between carriage of the virus on the skin and the occurrence of squamous cell carcinoma. However, the molecular mechanism of HPV in causing squamous cell cancers has not been elucidated. Dr. Aaron states that immunocompetent patients that have warts on the skin do not necessarily put them at higher risk for developing squamous cell carcinoma. However, there is some evidence that immunosuppressed organ transplant recipients that have multiple flat warts or verrucous papillomas are more likely to develop squamous cell carcinomas. This may be more reflective of their overall level of immunosuppression, rather than degeneration of existing warts into cancer. Dr. Aaron explains some theories on the molecular mechanisms of HPV in squamous cell cancer. These mechanisms differ from those involved in cervical cancer. In cervical cancer, there are 2 to 6 copies of HPV per cell, and HPV may integrate into the genome of the cell. In addition, HPV blocks the cell's normal machinery for preventing an abnormal or cancer cell from dividing. So the cell begins to divide and divide and divide, and it turns into a frank invasive carcinoma. On the other hand, for cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, there may be 1 copy per 100 to 1,000 keratinocytes. Using deep sequencing methods, there is evidence of integration, and there are no molecular changes in the genome of the squamous cell cancer depending on whether it has HPV in it or not. While it is unclear how HPV causes cutaneous cancer, the prevailing theory is HPV is functioning with a hit-and-run mechanism. That is, HPV interacts with the cell in an early actinic keratosis and destabilizes that cell, so that when UV-induced mutations occur, the cell is then predisposed to cancer. However, when that cell becomes cancerous, the HPV is no longer required to maintain this cancerous state. In addition, the most common HPV subtypes involved in cutaneous cancers are HPV 5, 8, 19, 20, and 21. The high-risk types, HPV 16 and 18, are not involved in skin cancer, with the exception of periungual squamous cell carcinoma. These current theories on the role of HPV in squamous cell carcinoma and possible molecular mechanisms may lead to therapies that may be part of our armamentarium in the future. I hope you enjoyed this special skin cancer edition, and I hope you have made plans to get involved in a skin cancer awareness project in your community. Next month, we look forward to 3 new dialogues, and we're also preparing a special bonus edition of dialogues devoted to advocacy in our specialty. Remember to download the Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone. We also have a presence on Facebook, and would like you to join the community online for fun previews and educational info. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. Stay passionate about dermatology and keep up all the great work you're doing on behalf of your patients. Your expertise and your commitment to care is truly appreciated. Have another great month.